Dámy, vážení pánové, pokračujeme naší dnešní konferenci čtvrtou částí dnešního dne. Než vůbec začneme náš pořad, tak bych dovolil zástupci Litvy panu Žigerisovi, aby tady představil nějakou knihu, jenom kratičké vystoupení.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. About reports, about wonderful Hungarian reports, about reports. So I would like to remind that our, and it's very good that Mr. Lindblad is here and Madam Hibashkova, on the beginning of all this movement 3 years ago facing European Commission and Mr. Frattini, it was the idea to have national reports from every country to European Commission to present approved reports. Yes. So in this case, in the future, I think it will be very good if the conference can address to European Commission, still have under auspices of Commission, still have hearing in Brussels from the reports created in every country about totalitarian regimes. So I would like to pass our Lithuanian, the draft of our Lithuanian report. The full report will be approved after some time by all possible Lithuanian institutions dealing with that to Pavel Žačiko, to Nila, or to Madam Hibashkova, and to include to your legacy of this conference, and to say that we hope to represent this in the future in Brussels. Thank you very much.
Dámy a pánové, než se dostaneme k vlastnímu jednání, tak bych řekl něco ze svých pocitů. Totiž připadám si tady téměř jako takový nepřípadný, protože si připadám jako nějaký relikt mezi tolika vědci, zde se mluvilo jenom o samé vědě a já nejsem vědec, já jsem ten, který je pamětníkem celého toho dění, o kterém se zde mluvilo, na vlastním těle. Protože i když jsem absolventem Filozofické fakulty Masarykovy univerzity, tak jsem to dělal na 3x, protože než jsem dokončil, tak mě zatkli a diplom jsem dostal v 90. roce, ale hlavně strávil jsem 11 let ve vězení, v různých věznicích a na Uranu, takže všechny tyto záležitosti, které se zde probíraly, znám přímo na svém vlastním těle. A mimo jiné teda můj strýc byl odsouzen jako voják zahraniční armády západní, byl odsouzen k smrti a popraven, a můj otec a můj bratr skončili také ve vězení. To je jenom na úvod. A takže ten podrobný životopis samozřejmě by měl být jenom připomenutí, že zločiny proti lidskosti, které jsou obsahem této konference, prožívali tak jako já tisíce mých kamarádů na svých vlastních tělech. A pro líčení těch konkrétních osobních osudů a prožitků samozřejmě zde není časový prostor, ale všechny ty prožité situace by splňovaly charakter zločinů proti lidskosti. Všechny znamenaly totiž přímé fyzické násilí, ponižování lidské důstojnosti, nátlak ke konání činů, které se příčili mému svědomí a kterým bylo možné čelit pouze za cenu následné osobní perzekuce. A mnohé znamenaly přímé ohrožení života. Jenom třeba takovou situaci na ilustraci, jakým způsobem také STB pracovala i na lágrech, že když jsem prostě z ničeho nic si pro mě přišli na směně, hodili mě do korekce, o slovu korekce už tady byla řeč, to byla betonová kopka po rozměru 2x1,5 metru, kde rozbitým okénkem padal do ní sníh, protože to byl únor 1954. Venku byly teploty mezi minus 20 a minus 30. Uvnitř se samozřejmě netopilo a jíst a pít jsem dostal jenom, když se na mě vzpomněli. A takže po týdnu tohohle pobytu v té ledové rakvi si mě zavolal Listebák a nutil mě ke spolupráci. A když jsem to samozřejmě okamžitě briskně odmítl, no tak jsem nevěděl, jestli vytáhne revolver, který měl za pasem a bouchne mě mezi oči, anebo ne. No nebouchl, tak, protože jinak bych vám to tady nepovídal. Ale to jsou prostě zážitky, které vám nikdy nevymizí z paměti. A které ovšem člověka jenom posilují, když je překoná. A překonat je může jenom tehdy, když se v takových situacích nehroutí, nepodléhá depresi a nepodléhá strachu. A tak jsem vykonal jsem stovky hodin přednášek na školách všech stupňů. A vždycky těm studentům nechávám tam svůj vzkaz. Nenechte si nikdy nikým a ničím zničit svoje dobré chtění. Nikdy se nikoho a ničeho nebojte a nikdy se nevzdávejte. A oni tomu rozumějí. Díky Bohu. Při norimberském procesu byla poprvé v historii souzena státní ideologie v osobách jejich hlasatelů, nositelů i vykonavatelů. Ideologie, která vedla k apokalyptickým důsledkům, jež ovlivnili celý poválečný svět. Nacismus a Norimberg jsou dnes historií. Norimberg s druhým systémem zla, s mezinárodním komunismem, se však nekonal a nikdy konat nebude. Některý alespoň tato mezinárodní konference slouží jako důrazná připomínka jeho zločinů. Neboť pokud živi budeme, musíme se snažit o to, abychom nepřipustili vymazání paměti na tuto krutou a temnou dobu evropských i národních dějin. A nyní předám slovo našim řečníkům. Jako první vystoupí paní doktora Andrea Valič, ředitelka studijního centra pro národní usmíření v Ljubljaně, Slovinsko. Účastnila se mnoha národních a zahraničních projektů z oblasti historie. Je autorkou učebnic dějepisu. Prosím paní doktorku Valič, aby nám přednesla svůj příspěvek.
Dear colleagues, dear friends, first of all, I would like to thank you, the organizers, for inviting me and for organizing such an excellent event. And I would also like to express my gratitude to the director, Pavel Žáček, who I think was a very important part of dealing with our common European totalitarian past. Now I would like to present a small part of national report of the crimes of communism in Slovenia, and this national report was a collective work. I was dividing this summary into two parts. The first part deals with more historical analysis, and the second part with assessment, legal assessment. After an Axis attack on Yugoslavia on the 6th April of 1941, Slovenia, which at that time had approximately 1 million of people, was occupied by Italy, Germany and Hungary. The communists took the initiative in organizing the resistance at the end of April 1941, establishing the anti-imperialist front, renamed the Liberation Front only after the German attack on the Soviet Union. From the very beginning, the struggle for total control was more important to the communists than any struggle against the occupation. It was decided in advance that the communists would fight against every other group which planned resistance against the occupation. The Liberation Front never discussed equality of rights among collaborating groups or the appropriate division of tasks. The German attack on the Soviet Union provoked Yugoslav and Slovenian communists to start fighting against the occupation and to enact the Bolshevik Revolution. In August 1941, the Security Intelligence Service was established. It was directly subordinated to the Communist Party and executed collaborators, supposed collaborators, and enemies of the Liberation Front and the Communism. On September 16, 1941, the Slovene National Liberation Committee, controlled by the party, announced the prevention of operations of all organizations and resistance groups outside the Liberation Front. This day marks the formal beginning of the civil war on the Slovenian territory. So by the end of 1941, 100 people had lost their lives. They were shot because of alleged denunciation and betrayal. People were violently forced to join the partisans. The causes of growing violence, which greatly increased in this period, lay in the conviction of the Communist Party that the war would be decided in 1942. During the war, 1,000 civilians were killed by the partisans. These were people who represented ideological enemies for the party. They did not liquidate only the opponents of the Liberation Front, but also allies. They obviously tried to prepare the ground for a later communist takeover. After the war, we have to differentiate between two phases in the worst communist repression. The repression which was somehow forecasted by Tito's speech during his visit in Ljubljana in May 45. First, we must remember the bloody battle with the Home Guards and other members of armed anti-communist and partly collaborationist units, the elimination of some most exposed anti-communists and entrepreneurs, and the fight with the German minority on the Slovene territory. Then follows the period from August 45 until the middle of the 50s, when terror weakened. At the end of war, in May 45, the Home Guards, so-called Domobranci, at that time officially part of the Slovene army, together with many civilians, more than 6,000 of them, withdrew to Austrian Carinthia. They entered the occupied territory of British 5th Corps of the 8th Army, which occupied Carinthia. The British authorities began to return different anti-communists to Yugoslavia at the end of May. 11,000 Slovene soldiers and about 600 civilians were returned. The British mostly assured them that they would only transfer them to the camps in Italy. Although the Slovene anti-communist military and political leadership soon found that the returned Home Guard members had been transformed to Yugoslavia, they did not act effectively. They were probably guided by almost blind trust in the British political and military authorities, which grew during the war. They could not imagine that they could be extradited to the Yugoslav communist and non-democratic authorities by a country with a rich democratic tradition and gentlemanly behavior. A year ago, the biggest murder site was excavated in the Slovenian territory in the abandoned mine called Huda Jama. Many concentration camps have been established in the Slovenian territory, and according to its Bolshevik revolutionary justice, in 1945, the communist powers committed judicial slaughter outside the courts on Slovene territory, about which it was forbidden to talk until 1990. There are more than 610 mass graves in Slovenia. Most of them have been revealed in the past 5 years. In 1945, Slovenia was gripped by a wave of confiscations which followed the mass persecution of real and imagined speculators. In summer 45, a special court was established. It carried out the authorities carried out agrarian reform and divided the confiscated estates of landowners and the Catholic Church among small peasants and country people. By this means, they got the poorer peasants on their side. But these small rural producers could not replace the fall in production, which resulted from the destruction and nationalization of large land establishments. In June 45, group trials began against actual and imaginary opponents of the communist system, particularly against representatives of cooperatives, banks, and the economy. The authorities carried out numerous trials to compromise representatives of political opposition and the Catholic Church. From April 48 to October 49, the so-called Dachau trials were held, 9 trials, before a military court or district court against former internees at Buchenwald and Dachau. They were accused of collaborating with the Gestapo. All the accused were pre-war communists, activists in the Liberation Front or partisans. Some of them even Spanish fighters. Others had senior positions, particularly economic. 15 were sentenced to death. 11 were executed. 3 died in prison. 20 were sentenced to long terms of imprisonment. Throughout the whole totalitarian period, political trials involved some 25,000 people, about 2% of the Slovene pre-war population. Among the post-war trials before the civil court, trials against bigger farmers or kulaki, known as the kulak trials, deserve special attention. They were also political in nature. They took place particularly between 49-51, when the campaign for collectivization and so-called socialization was at its peak in Slovenia. The secret and violent actions of secret political police also enabled the regime to terrorize the public. The regime tried to create the appearance of the rule of law by issuing many different, even revolutionary laws and legal decrees, which actually confirmed that the rule of law was not possible. The judiciary was also subordinated to political authority because the courts became a body for the class struggle of workers against the class enemies. Up to the end of the 1950s, there were strict controls on the frontiers of Slovenia or Yugoslavia at that time, just as on the other frontiers between the Eastern and Western Bloc. After 1960, this regime weakened, and the numbers of escapes over the border decreased, as foreign travel and economic migration were permitted. Before that, there were mass illegal escapes. The Catholic Church in Slovenia represented the largest problem for the communist regime because it was the only one which stayed organized outside the party and had widespread support from the religious population. Therefore, on the one hand, the communists wanted to slander the church in public and on the other hand, destroy its economic basis. Only in Slovenia, priests needed authority consents if during war they were not in their posts. Some 630 priests, monks, nuns, and seminarists were imprisoned or in concentration camps. Many fake trials were held against church representatives. 9 priests were sentenced to death, and 4 death penalties were executed. The most important trial against the church in Slovenia took place in 1946, before a military court in Ljubljana against the Bishop of Ljubljana, Dr. Grigori Rožman. Now, I would like to say a few words on assessment of crimes. As I told you before, after the German attack on Yugoslavia, the situation in Slovenia during the Second World War was extremely complex. And all 3 occupiers wanted to ethnically destroy the Slovenian nation. During the Second World War, the international war law was equally valid for all parties, for members of the occupying forces as well as for the civilian population in the occupied territory. As Communist Party of Slovenia, as part of the Communist Party of Yugoslavia, in 1941 expected an imminent end of war and a revolution, at that period of time its tactic was very offensive and it devoted much more attention to the preparation of the proletarian revolution as to the cooperation with allies within the national liberation movement. After the first wave of brutal methods, immediately after the war, the secret political police began to apply subtler methods, multiple interrogations, physical pressure, threats by courts, blackmail with pressure on family members or professional colleagues and friends, persecution, and in particular, denunciation among people who belong to the same circle, belief and party, which was called differentiation. Among the typical human rights violations in Slovenia are violation of the right to life and physical integrity, violation of the right to personal freedom, violation of the right of human dignity, violation of property rights, violation of the right to citizenship, violation of fundamental legal rights. A special form of violating human rights and fundamental freedoms in the former state was the existence of a secret code of law. It was sent to various recipients. The number ranged from 22 to approximately 40 recipients all over the country. From the regulatory aspect, the regulations on state security, internal affairs and social self-protection that were enforced at that time, along with the already mentioned secret implementing regulations, opened up to the political secret police unlimited possibilities for the violation of human rights. And at the conclusion, I would like to add something about the legal qualification of massacres in the Slovenian territory as crimes against humanity. Massacres in the Slovenian territory after the war can be qualified as crimes against humanity. The Governmental Commission for Settlement of Hidden Mass Graveyards has so far found between, as I told you, approximately 600 hidden mass grave sites on the territory of Slovenia. In order to identify it, the acts committed after the Second World War on Slovenian territory would qualify as crimes against humanity, it is necessary to first identify the crimes against humanity, and the first common element is the most important, that the conduct was committed as part of a widespread or systematic attack directed against a civilian population. So far, there have been only two cases brought for alleged totalitarian communist crimes before Slovenian criminal courts in the newly democratic Slovenia. The most notorious case was Prosecutor versus Mitja Ribičič. Mitja Ribičič was the first former official of Slovenian Communist Party to be charged in Slovenia for crimes against humanity since the end of the totalitarian regime in 1990. Documents found in the Slovene National Archive reportedly allege that in 1945 Mitja Ribičič helped to draft a list of 217 people for execution. Mitja Ribičič was a deputy head in the Slovenian branch of the Yugoslav secret political police and afterwards a high politician in socialist Yugoslavia. On 13 May 2005, the Slovenian police filed a criminal complaint for genocide against Mitja Ribičič for his role in the massacres. The 86-year-old Ribičič, who is still alive, was suspected of having ordered the murder of 217 people without trial. In April 2006, the Supreme State Prosecutor's Office of Slovenia presented the investigating judge of the District Court of Ljubljana with a request to open a judicial criminal investigation against Ribičič. After examining the written documents and questioning the suspect, The investigating judge held that there was no basis for instituting criminal proceedings against Ribičić. The investigating judge held that crimes against humanity committed on Slovenian territory in the months following the war at that time were not prescribed and criminalized in domestic criminal law or at the international level. Additionally, the investigating judge justified her opinion on the basis of Article 28 of the Constitution of Slovenia, prohibiting retroactivity in criminal law. Alternatively, the investigating judge held that the prosecutor failed to present evidence. The chamber of the district court dismissed the reasoning of the investigating judge that the provisions of the Slovenian Criminal Code concerning crimes against civilian population could not apply retroactively. Since evidence was missing, the court concluded that investigation could not be opened. So the problem finally was evidence. And I would like to conclude with the statement that no judicial sentences have been so far delivered in the Republic of Slovenia. And besides the fact that Slovenia was not able to adopt any condemnation of its communist past or communist crimes, also the problems of evidence and, of course, the problems of archives remain open. Thank you for your attention.
Děkuji paní doktorce Valič za její přínosný referát. Národní usmíření, které má její studijní centrum ve svém pojmenování, je zajisté žádoucí pro každou část světa. A tím více však pro donedávna velmi rozjitřený prostor bývalé Jugoslávie. Rumunské vymanění se ze komunismu bylo provázeno krvavými událostmi, jaké se při naší sametové revoluci neodehrávaly. Rumunská státní bezpečnost Securitate zůstala v povědomí občanů jako obzvláště zločinná organizace. Pan doktor Máriuš Oprea, prezident Ústavu pro vyšetřování komunistických zločinů, je velmi dobrý znalec této represivní organizace. Je autorem více než stovky článků týkajících se dění Securitate. Prosím nyní pana doktora Opreu, aby nás seznámil se svými poznatky.
I think all of us, we have a big problem. How to condemn the communism? How to use the democratic tools against of the totalitarian system? This is mainly our problem. How to deal with the past? How to condemn in a practical way, the communist system? Because we don't have the tools. We have seminars like that one. We have a lot of speeches. We have a lot of point of view on that. But it's a difference, you know? The difference is that, and I want to show you that. What is the difference? The difference is, you know, this is the state. Because the forensics, they have the gloves. But we don't have the gloves. We found the bodies, which was buried in common graves, you know. But they have all the tools, practically. They said, you know, those crimes was prescribed as ordinary crimes, not as a crimes against humanity, not as a Holocaust. Why not? Is not a similar that man was 76 years old, and we found him in the mud. You know. Was awful for us to work to see something like that. It's very difficult. We discussed in a theoretical way in many times about the crimes of the communism. But those are the crimes. We must identify the bodies, we must identify the crime in a particular way, not in theory. I'm said enough about seminaries and theories and we must go on the field. We must found the victims, because the crimes a crime start with a victim. We must found the victim, and after that we identify the criminal. Like Wiesenthal Committee, you know. In that way, I think we have enough time till now, after 20 years, after 89, to understand the criminal nature of the communism. But now we must start to identify victims and the criminals. What was with the Holocaust? The Holocaust was put in a public conscience after 20 years after the war. I think the same process will be the communist crimes. And we must be prepared on that. We must identify the victims first. First, we must to discuss with the victims and with the relatives of the victims. From that point of view, I think we must establish the truth. We are not able to forget something. We must to go on the field in a practical way and to find the victims. This is our duty. Not to have a lot of theories and to put in our scientific approach a lot of. In my country, we had a lot of. For example, I can give you some numbers if you want to have. In Romania, was executed without any sentence more than 10,000 people. We found in last year 50. Just 50 from 10,000. All of them, they are underground, in graves without any cross. That is our duty. To found them, to give them the bodies for the family is the first step. I think this is mainly the first approach. The second one, also very necessary, to modify the legislation, to have, let's say, in EU's countries, new penal codes, and to consider crimes which was committed in the name of the communism by the secret services or by the militia, police or something, by the system, let's say. Sistema, to be considered as a crimes against humanity. But for that, we must to have a common approach on that, and to start from the victims. To start from that, for example, from that old man, his name was Simeon. We found in his pocket just coin. And he was 76 years old when he was executed by the forces, by the Securitate, without any sentence. I think we must to start that process against of the communist regime with the victims, not from the theories, not with the ideology. With I think we know as historians what was happened with us during the communism, what was wrong with the communist ideology and Marxism and so on. So we must start to find the victims and to find the criminals. This is my personal approach, and excuse me if I'm not maybe I'm not in agreement with some of you, but I think that is the moment to let that scientific approach is necessary. Yes, I'm agree with that. I'm not against, because I'm historian. But let's go and to find the human suffering. Thank you.
Děkuji panu doktoru Opreu za to, že nás seznámil s touto částí působení zločinného mezinárodního komunismu. Pan Vasil Kadrinov, ředitel centra Hannah Arendtové v Sofii, je důkazem, že komunistický režim byl represivní až do konce svého trvání. V roce 1985 strávil rok ve vězení za agitaci a propagandu proti Bulharské lidové republice a Sovětskému svazu. Po pádu komunismu se stal členem Svazu demokratických sil, který mimo jiné nyní usiluje o založení Ústavu paměti národa. Prosím pana ředitele Kadrinova, aby nám sdělil své myšlenky k dnešnímu tématu.
Thank you, Mr. Krivka. Thank you for your words today that the courage is the most important thing in the totalitarian society, and thank you that you bring this message to the students in the schools. I will talk about the crimes of the Bulgarian totalitarian regime, and at the end of my report it will be some minutes for Mr. Shukri Mustafa, who is from the Turkish minority in Bulgaria. He will talk shortly about the terror on the Turkish minority from the Bulgarian communist regime. The Bulgarian Communist Party is responsible for the state governance in Bulgaria from 1944 to 1989 and for the establishment of the totalitarian communist regime in the country. The Bulgarian Communist Party seized the power on the night of September 1944 to a coup supported by a foreign country, the Soviet Union, which had declared war on Bulgaria. Founded in 1903 after a split in the Social Democratic Party, the Communist Party had failed to assert itself as a significant power in the Bulgarian politics. Its efforts to generate big electoral support were unsuccessful, and its parliamentary influence never matched that of the agrarian and the social democratic parties in the country. In the 20s, the party leader Georgi Dimitrov directed the party to collaboration with the Bolshevik totalitarian regime in Russia and to terrorist activities. In 1925, the communists prepared the St. Nedelya church assault in Sofia. 150 people, mainly from the country's political and military elite, were killed in the attack, and around 500 were injured. In the 30s, Dimitrov joined the clique of political gangsters surrounding Joseph Stalin and was repeatedly sending from Moscow during the Second World War calls for armed struggle against the capitalism in Bulgaria. Even the total number of communists involved in armed actions in the period of 1941 to 1944 in the country did not exceed 3,000. Immediately after the coup on 9th of September in 1944, the Communist Party started the acts of terror against the so-called bourgeois. People were killed in all towns and villages of the country. There was a directive of the Communist Party to its members to organize groups of executors with the aim to go to every village and kill 2-3 of the enemies of the people. The enemies were teachers, priests, civil servants, writers, journalists and civic leaders. The executors arrested the victims in their homes early in the morning, collected them in the municipality offices and killed them on the next night outside the settlement. But to their relatives who asked them, they answered that they must bring for their father or brother money, clothes and something to eat. And the spouses or mothers brought eating and money week after week until they understood that their relative is dead. Some of the killers forced the families of the victims to leave their houses, and the killers started to live there using the clothes of the killed by them victim. By the end of October 1944, were killed approximately 26,850 people without court sentences. The next stage of the communist terror began in December 1944 when the government installed special people's courts authorized to prosecute fascists. The government put on trial all members of all governments and all parliaments between 1941 and 1944. Each one of these individuals was sentenced to death, 1,050 death sentences overall. The verdicts were carried out immediately. The term fascist was applied to anyone who had opposed the communists in the past or might oppose them in the future. In addition to the judicial and extrajudicial murders, fascists were subjected to imprisonment. The people court sentenced to imprisonment 6,188 people. Deportations, approximately 5,000 families were sent into internal exile and incarceration. By the end of the 1945, approximately 10,000 people were brought to concentration camps. By the summer of 1945, several parties, the most popular of which was the Bulgarian Agricultural National Union, declared themselves in opposition to the communist government. Nikola Petkov, chairman of the party, became the main spokesman of the democratic resistance. The destruction of the opposition became a top priority for the communist party, and this murderous campaign was carried out under the guidance of the party's leader, Georgi Dimitrov. The last multi-party elections in Bulgaria were held in October 1946. Despite the persecution of the opposition activists and the systematic falsification of electoral results, in the countryside, the opposition still won 28 of the votes. In June 1947, Nikola Petkov was stripped of his immunity and arrested while delivering a speech in parliament. Charged with high treason, he was sentenced to death and hanged in September. Soon after, all non-communist organizations were banned, opposition deputies were arrested, and all remnants of the political pluralism were extinguished. As the process of the monopolization of power reached its final phase, the Communist Party initiated a massive effort to build a Soviet-type economy. By the end of 1949, all privately owned businesses, industrial enterprises, banks and trading companies were confiscated, and most of the owners of their families were exiled to the countryside. The last campaign against the private property targeted the rural areas where Soviet-style collectivization of land got underway in the late 40s. Officially described as voluntary, this campaign quickly turned violent. In several regions of the country, peasants rebelled. Private farmers were eliminated as a social group only after a series of punitive campaigns. Hundreds of people were murdered and thousands detained in 82 concentration camps. The biggest one was the camp at the Danube island Belene. The Goriani movement was an armed resistance against the Bulgarian communist regime. It began immediately after the coup of in 1944, reached its peak between 1947 and 1954, subsided the late 50s and ended by the early 60s. The movement covered the entire country, including urban areas. The members of the movement were dubbed Goriani. In Bulgarian, this means ones of the forest. Armed resistance to the communists began in the immediate aftermath of the coup in 1944 and reached sustainable proportions in the countryside after the execution of Nikola Petkov and the beginning of the banning of the Social Democratic Party in 1948. By the early 50s, the Bulgarian communist secret police had identified some 160 detachments of the Goriani, of which 52 were supplied from abroad or comprised hostile emigres who had infiltrated across borders. The Goriani had a radio station, a Radio Gorianin, which broadcast to Bulgaria from Greece. They hoped that the United States, United Kingdom and the other Western democracies will start a war against the totalitarian communist regimes in Europe, but after the passivity of the West during the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, their hope has been lost. This was the reason for the dumping of the Goriani movement in the late 50s. 1,040 armed members of the movement were killed by the communist regime in combats, and they are Bulgarian heroes who died in struggle against the totalitarian communism. Now, in the year of 2010, in Sofia there is not a single monument to the Goriani, but there is a big monument to the Soviet army whose occupation of the country brought the communists into power. Post-Stalinism in Bulgaria was characterized by the almost complete absence of political liberalization. It was during Zhivkov's tenure in late 1956 that one of Bulgaria's most horrible concentration camps, Lovech, came into existence. Over the next years, almost 200 musicians, journalists and peasants were beaten and tortured to death there. In the 60s, 70s and 80s, there were Bulgarians with anti-totalitarian courage who struggled against the communist regime as human rights defenders. Some of them, like Eduard Genov, Ilya Minev and Janko Jankov, were imprisoned for many years. Others, like Boris Arsov, Volodya Nakov and the writer Georgi Markov, were killed without court sentence. In 1988-1989, the opposition to the communist regime grew and contributed together with the struggles of the Democrats in Russia, Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Germany and China to its collapse. Zhivkov died being under home arrest in 1996, but nobody from the Communist Party Politburo and the other perpetrators of the communist crimes was convicted until now. And I want to tell you that this morning we heard the speech of Mr. Topolánek about the liberty and about the democracy. But I have to say you that in our country we have another prime minister who is talking other things. our Prime Minister Boyko Borisov in the 90s, in 1996, was a bodyguard of the former dictator Todor Živkov. And 2 years ago, in 2008, he said to an interview following words: "Konrad Adenauer is a great politician, Churchill too. If we look for their time, Hitler and Stalin were number one, too. And Mao, to be leader of one empire so much time, in such conditions, for these are qualities needed." So we have to think about these words of Prime Minister of post-totalitarian country, which is a member of the European Union and chair of party, member of the European People's Party. And we have to remember the words of Mr. Harry Wu today, that the President Bush didn't say something in China about the human rights. And we have to remember the speech of about the report of Belarus about the KGB. And I have to say that the ambassador of Russia to the European Union 2 years ago said that the Bulgaria have to be Trojan horse in the European Union. So, but I have to leave some time for my friend from the Mr. Shukri Mustafa, who was prisoner in the concentration camp Belene.
Please, shortly.
I don't want to take much time of you. Just I would like to inform you about our struggle in the Council of Europe and the European Parliament, and who are we. Dear organizers and guests, I'm thankful to all of you on behalf of the victims of the forced assimilation in Bulgaria committed by the totalitarian regime between 1984-1989. The period in question is extremely important, and without referring to the crimes acted by the regime during the forced assimilation, the issue will be incompleted. I would like to refer to the crimes committed during the period of the forced assimilation, the very beginning of 1985, when the state turned on the minorities with such a wildness as if it had been started a war against another state. The whole state machine has been directed on the regions populated by the minorities, the army, police troops, youth organizations of the Communist Party, armed volunteers, even the vagabonds have been armed in order to make the pressure more massive. It was incredible. Yesterday's friends and colleagues turned into supporters of the Forced Assimilation Act. Many people became collaborators in the actions of the persecution of the members of the minorities in the regions. All over the regions have been carried out arrests of hundreds of innocent people just for the reason that they would show disagreement to the assimilation process. The largest detentions have been carried out from 25 to 31 December 1984. The police stations were full of people who had expressed their disagreement with the policy of the regime. Without 3 months, more than 500 people have been put in the concentration camp on Island Belene, and nearly 400 people have been imprisoned by fake courts. The persecutions continued until 1989, to the time when 350,000 people have been deported within 72 days to Turkey. 1 million people were killed spiritually. It has passed more than 20 years from this time. Unfortunately, Only the former prisoners on Island Belene concentration camp did not give up the fight against the leaders and executors of the forced assimilation. Firstly, in Bulgaria we brought the issue to all of the relevant offices, political and legal. We tried to involve in this fight the political parties, but no one of them had any intention to help us in our case. And as for our activities in the Council of Europe and in Brussels, in the Council of Europe, the relevant offices of the Council of Europe Monitoring Committee and Commissioner for Human Rights published reports supporting our fight and expressed that the claims of the victims of the forced assimilation and the victims of the totalitarian regime, no matter the ethnic origin, are legitimate. The first one was published last year, 31 March 2009, and the second one in February this year, by Thomas Hammarberg and Mr. Holovaty. Before conclusion of my speech, I would like to express our wish to take part in the conference like this one and keep contact with the institutes and the working group, the Platform of Europe Memory and Conscience. And I would like to say last that we have not seen any organization of victims of the force of the totalitarian regimes to struggle in the Council of Europe and in the European Parliament in Brussels and the relevant offices put the question why you are deprived of the support of the organizations of the victims from the other countries, from the Turkish minority in Bulgaria and the Turkish community emigrated to Turkey. Yes, we are alone. Until now, we have not seen any organizations to struggle like our organization. And I beg you, we are here to support our organization in the fight in the Council of Europe, in Brussels, at least by sending written letters, fax, and like one. Thank you. Thank you.
Děkuji oběma řečníkům za jejich projevy osvětlující situaci v Bulharsku. Bývalý stát Jugoslávie je oblastí, která prošla snad největším politickými změnami ze všech států Evropy. Dnes se rozpadla na řadu nástupnických států, byla držena pohromadě jen komunistickou železnou pěstí Josipa Broze Tita. Po jeho smrti nastal proces rozpadu. Paní Marina Jelič se narodila v Bělehradě ve státě Jugoslávie. Dnes žije v témže městě, ale ve státě Srbská republika. Je výkonnou ředitelkou Centra pro mír a rozvoj demokracie. Prosím paní ředitelku Jelič, aby nám osvětlila situaci ve své zemi.
Dear ladies and gentlemen, I just want to say I'm not from Republika Srpska, it's Republic of Serbia, because Republika Srpska is the part of Bosnia, so just to clarify that. Well, I'm coming from Republic of Serbia, and in my case, in this is not relevant to the subject of this meeting in general, because as you say, till the beginning of 90s, the Serbia was a part of larger administrative territory, Socialist Federative Republic of Yugoslavia. It is interesting to know that collapse of this complex country, the coincidence with the fall of Berlin Wall or collapse of communist systems in countries of Central and Eastern Europe. From this previously mentioned, it is going to conclude that the communist regime we can only discuss in the context of Yugoslavia, not in Serbia. Because Serbia, after the collapse, was in a particular way totalitarian organized state, but not as a classic communist model, one party system, state ownership, lack of freedom press, and etc. So. After the collapse of federal countries, Serbia went into the wars, and the situation was too much complex to deal with the far past as Yugoslavia. So it is clear that we can only talk about communist regime crimes only in so-called second Yugoslavia, which was epoch from 1945 until 1990s. It seems to me that history of this country in relation to the crimes especially, but not only to them, we can roughly divide into three periods. First period from 1945 to 1948 could be called period of revolutionary terror. This was the revolutionary war, the sentence which famous first communist then dissident Milovan Djelos. So in these years, the first period, during the first period, the largest number of crimes were committed not only to the members of defeat military groups from World War II, Chetniks, Nedics, Ljotiches, and other, and Domobrani and Ustasha of Croats, and etc., but on the civilians that didn't fit in ideological or economical matrix of new society that was emerging in Yugoslavia by receipt of existing arrangement in Soviet Union. So here I think particularly on big capitalists, members of opposition of Marxist ideology, the large parts of peasantries and clergy, of course. During the first, after war years, there are numerous examples of unjust confiscations of property, losses of civil rights, conviction on long prison sentences, without valid or any evidence and with dubious legal procedure. Concerning the mass crimes, case Bleiburg, the place in today's Austria, especially stands out when partisans units executed tens of thousands of Croats and with their families and who were found in withdrawing to the West. Also nearly in all Serbian towns, mass executions of members of families, sympathizers and members of anti-communist movements were conducted with inadequate and often without any kind of court proceeding. After sudden and abrupt change in Yugoslav politics that happened in 1948, which was caused by breakup of ties between USSR and Yugoslavia, and the friendship between Tito and Stalin, second period of history of communistic Yugoslavia began. During this time, still powerful representative state apparatus turned rather than against ideological opponents to the yesterday's friends and comrades, who in conflict of these two communistic dictators choose the foreign one. So ideological police terror against common citizen weakened, but instead of that the Goli Otok was created. The Goli Otok is an island of now Croatia, Adriatic Sea. So Goli Otok was created as a work camp located in the sea and intended primarily for communists of pro-Soviet orientations. Besides inhuman behavior like beating, starving, various kind of humiliation, It is considered that on Goliatok between 5 and 10,000 people was murdered or died as cause of this. So large number of these men hasn't committed criminal offense or hasn't, for example, participated in armed rebellion or something like that, but simply by habit or some of them by the conviction in conflict of these two regimes choose the Soviets. So the fact that Stalin regime conducted even more hideous crimes doesn't reprieve Yugoslavian leadership from the crimes against his compatriots. And at the end, and the last period of history of Yugoslavia was lasted from 1954 until 1990, started symbolically with two opposing events. In 1956, Goliotok was closed, but the most famous Yugoslav dissident, Milovan Djilas, was deposed and arrested because he published in daily newspaper Borba series of articles, which will on the West also later grow into a famous book, New Class. Djilas, although in youth one of the most diligent and closest Tito's associates, during the 50s and 60s had served 9 years of prison because of his new faith in liberal and democratic ideas. So now it would be maybe useful to say more about the nature of Yugoslavian communism. It was something different. It was a self-administrative socialism, as it was called in the final and the longest phase of existence of this common state. So although the basic feature of the state orientation was as the country of real socialism, basically, the significant difference was from their ideological brethren for European East, because foreign policy position of this country was in large part conditioned by breakup with Warsaw Pact countries led by the Soviet Union. That's why formerly communist Yugoslavia was vastly materially financed by United States and developed Western European countries. So further on, political openness toward the West results in relatively openness of Yugoslavian market to goods and also to ideas that created in these West countries. Besides that, Yugoslavian companies often served as a mediator in trade between countries from the one and the other side of Iron Curtain. So at the height of bloc division of the world in the early 60s, Yugoslavian authorities accepted the idea and forming the idea of non-alignment that enables cooperation and trade with distant and populous non-European countries and the nations. So foreign policy openness forced the need for inner liberalization, so form of private property was allowed, like small shops, restaurants, craft workshops, and the rural population was unable to have a private possession of a significant part of the land. So the possibility of free travel completes this picture to a relatively liberal economical and prosperous society. In this kind of ambient lack of political freedom and civil rights wasn't hard on majority of population. Seriously organized challenges to one party monolith and charismatic leader Tito almost didn't exist. Therefore, the need for the large-scale repression also didn't exist, although enforcement devices like army and police, like in other communist countries, stayed powerful, well organized, and without any civic their work. So naturally, occasional rebellion existed, mostly from the intellectuals, like literates, scientists, artists, but this sporadic excess couldn't jeopardize the foundation of one party system. Few serious crises we can mention. One are the foundation of a massive movement in Croatia in 1971 and student protest in Belgrade in 1968 that started as a way of similar events across Europe. But students, on the other hand, demands liberalization of social life. But on the other, they try to return to original communistic principles of war and early post-war period. So you can see that was a picture of that. So both moments were suppressed with practical no human casualties. Some of the leaders were sentenced to prison. But no one killed and no one died because of that. In a certain way, death of dictator Tito announced the end of Yugoslavian state project. The political freedom was started to be gained more and more. So during the 80s of the last century, almost any opinion you can find in the press, although the monopoly of political sphere stayed in hands of one own and only allowed party, Communists of Yugoslavia. So the society during the middle of 19th decade was quite different than before. So I try to cut up my speech because everybody is so exhausted, so I'll see. Okay. Okay. Well, when we can have the into serious consideration in crimes, huge crimes against humanity was only on earliest historical period of existence of socialist Yugoslavia. Well, summary of criminal proceedings. Okay, now I will come to the point because I come from Serbia and I will limit myself to the situation in that former Yugoslav Republic. In our case, after 1989, League of Communists of Serbia hasn't, as it happened in other countries, left the government and went into the opposition. The League of Communists of Serbia united with the Socialist Union of Working People. It was a kind of para-party formation, a relapse from the time of socialism, and formed Socialist Party of Serbia. This new organization, new by the name only, ruled alone in a coalition with other parties. So that lasted for more than 10 years. So that party not only inherited of all the property of this socialist union of working people, but also obtained enforcement devices like army and police of disappearing countries. So naturally, with this state of society, there couldn't have been place to talk about criminal procedures of individual which broke the laws before 1989 for two reasons. First, because there wasn't mass crime in the last decades of existence of Yugoslavia, and secondly, because the inter-ethnic armed conflict was beginning on territory of Yugoslavia and the military and police forces were sorely and necessarily needed to stay in war. So the prosecution of some of its members wouldn't be particularly opportune for this kind of role. So, although Serbia wasn't formally in war, but deeply present in wars in Croatia and Bosnia and Herzegovina, welfare caused major human casualties and severe destruction, and serious crime were committed, including genocide. So those could be subsumed under the category the crimes against humanity. But as I said, it wasn't the communist, clear communist regime. So because of these events, the International Criminal Tribunal from the former Yugoslavia was established in Hague, and the tribunal deals with the processing of persons associated with these crimes. In recent years, the newly created states in the Balkan criminally prosecute some individuals suspected to have committed crimes during the war years. So, in Serbia alone, there was no conflict, if you exclude NATO airstrike, but the Serbia, as I said, was deeply involved in all these crimes ex-Yugoslavia territory. Just to mention that there were, however, sporadic crimes committed under the state, such as the murders of famous journalist Slavko Ćuruvija, former politician Ivan Stambolić, and three opposition party leaders from Serbia Renewal Movement. So, moral norms underlying social life in Serbia were destroyed. A large number of young professionals leaving the country, and a considerable number of young people turned to crime and various other socially unacceptable behavior. In this context, in the conditions of global economic and moral crisis and disorientation in Serbia, it is difficult to talk about correcting the undoubted but long ago committed injustice and violations that took place in now non-existent country Yugoslavia. Thank you.
Děkuji paní ředitelce Marině Jelič za její podrobné a přínosné informace o situaci v její zemi. Milí přátelé, druhá ze dvou totalitních pohrom 20. století, mezinárodní komunismus, je dnes ve své mocenské podobě historií. Je to však nelidská historie, neboť historii, která za sebou zanechává hory mrtvých, potoky krve a oceány slz, nelze nazvat lidskou. Milí přátelé, protože jsme v časovém skluzu a máme neúprosný časový limit, tak bohužel diskuzní část se dnes už nemůže odehrávat. Proto prosím, přenesme tuto část na zítřejší jednání. Takže vám děkuji za pozornost i účast a zítra nashledanou.